Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. It's true. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the wonderful Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. We just wrapped up another killer yearly writers conference. Ended August 1st or July 30th? July 30th. And it was another good one, boy. Robert Dagoni gave a moving, powerful keynote address, very well attended conference. We had a fabulous panel Friday night with Stephen James and Sheila Roberts and Jerry Russell and, oh, Cece Humphreys, the charming Cece Humphreys. Great. In fact, you can watch conversations. I did two conversations, one with Sheila Roberts and one with Stephen James. Both will be up on Author Magazine, starting with Sheila for our August issue, which will be out next week, and then Stephen James's, my conversation with Stephen, will be in the September issue, so you can have that to look forward to. Now, my guest today, I hope, is Stephen Metcalf, screenwriter, playwright, and novelist. He's not shown up yet, but I'm hoping he will. I'll tell you why. He's got a great new novel out called The Practical Navigator. It's about a man going through sort of a great many turmoils in the middle of his life. But one of those challenges is, and part of the reason I was contacted by his wonderful publicist, is because the son in this character, in this novel of our protagonist, is on the autism spectrum. He's a young boy who's got all the challenges of Asperger's, what we call Asperger's, and Stephen had read my essay in the New York Times called No One Is Broken and really wanted to talk about the parenting as it relates to having kids like that. And, oh, boys and girls, I think I spy a Stephen Metcalf. Even now, let's wait and see. I think this is him. Stephen, is that you?
Bill, it is. I'm so sorry. I thought you were going to call me, and then I just saw the message to call you, so here I am.
Yeah, I know. It gets confusing. We're a little low-tech here, Stephen. You have to call us. It's just the way it works. Well, you called just at the right time. I was just telling our listeners about your wonderful book, The Practical Navigator. Actually, let me just, in case anybody, in case I didn't really give you a full, proper introduction, You're a playwright, and your plays include Love and Hours, Vikings, Strange Snow, Sorrows and Sons, Pilgrims, Half a Lifetime, Emily, White Linen, the incredibly famous Willie Rivers, White Man Dancing, A World of Their Own, and The Gift Teller. And your plays have been produced in New York and regional theaters across the United States, as well as Europe and Japan. Congratulations on that. And your screen credits include Half a Lifetime, Cousins, Jackknife, Roommate, El Abuelo, and Beautiful Joe. And you're the author of two novels, actually, The Tragic Age and now The Practical Navigator, which, when was that published, Stephen?
It is actually being released today.
Oh, how I'm honored. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations. All right, so here's novel number two. Whoa, what a list of credits. You tell all kinds of stories. Were you, the novels, are they just an offshoot of screen and stage, or have they always been one of your, part of the your desire as a writer?
Well, it's interesting. I think way back when I was very, very interested in fiction. When I was in college, I got involved in a drama program, which aimed me towards the theater. And when I was in my early 20s, I moved to New York City and really was involved with the theater there for quite some time. The theater brought me to San Diego in like the mid-80s, and just around that time, I had started getting work in the film industry, and so that sort of grabbed my attention for quite some time, and I think it was about 8 or 9 years ago where I really felt a need to start really investigating my own stories, and I had always in the back of my mind wanted to try fiction, and so I just thought it was time to do that.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you, I have a friend who's a playwright and a television, writes for television also,
Sure.
And he wrote very sort of experimental theater, and now he writes television, which is not really his stuff isn't particularly experimental. It's drama. And I know that and he had a beautiful prose voice too, but the voice of the playwright and certainly screenwriter is so different than the voice that you have to find as a prose writer.
Yes.
Was that challenging for you, or was it really delicious to be able to sink into the language in that way? Although not to say that playwriting is also, I think, very language based, and I have to say,
yes.
But in a different way.
Well, it's interesting. I've been asked that question a couple of times now, and it seems to me, I've actually heard it said that you could go to listen to a play and you go to see a movie, which strikes me as saying one thing, you're listening to dialogue. The dialogue establishes the characters and it moves the action forward in the theater. When you go to see a film, yes, there's character and dialogue, but as often as not, the visual action is moving the story forward.
Yeah.
And I have found that I find writing fiction has sort of become a combination of both. I mean, I've compared it to suddenly, not only are you the writer, you're the director, the actor, the set designer, you're the whole nine yards.
Yeah, I had the pleasure to interview Nora Ephron before she passed away, and she talked about this was just shortly before she passed, in fact. And she talked about it seems so obvious when I heard it from her, but the intense collaborative nature of filmmaking, that everyone's making a film, that the actors are making a film, and the set designers are making a film. It's such a hugely a collaborative effort compared to the book where, except for the editor, you're going solo.
Well, the other thing I have actually said about working on fiction is that it is so much more solitary than writing a play and working on a movie. When you're working on a play, you're sharing it with actors. You're sharing it with the director. If you go into a rehearsal situation, it's enormously collaborative. When you're working on a film, as Nora Ephron would say, yes, you're working with actors, producers, directors. And that's enormously collaborative. And all of a sudden, it seems to me now for the last 8 or 9 years, I pretty much go into my office in the morning and I come out at the end of the day and it's like, okay, what now?
Do you like that? Is that okay?
I think earlier on in my life, I don't think I would have enjoyed it as much as I do now.
Yeah.
And having said that, I fill my day with a lot of different things. So, I actually do like it.
Good. Well, I can't remember who there's certain questions I always ask the authors I interview, and one of them talked about that the thing the writer must like above all is to be alone. You have to be, you have to look forward to it in a way and be comfortable with it. And God knows I'm that way. And my wife's a writer too. And so we are very comfortable leaving each other alone, but also being together,
it's usually about maybe 3-4 hours, but my wife is also a writer.
Yeah.
When she sits down, she goes, she can go 8 or 9 hours and not.
Seriously?
The most amazing thing. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I don't know how she does it.
Because 3 or 4 hours, and some, to some of our listeners, well, you're all writers, but a lot of you have day jobs probably, or some of you have day jobs, and that may not sound like a lot, but 3 or 4 hours is a lot of time spent writing, and you can get a lot done in 3 or 4 hours and really be done at that point.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure Bill, that when I say 3 or 4 hours, I think if I accomplish maybe a good 90 minutes of what I consider good work, and I consider it a very successful day.
You know what else I've been thinking about lately, Stephen, around the concept of work as a writer? I say, okay, now I'm working. I'm in front of my computer. I write at a computer. And now I've left, and I'm done working. But it's such BS because so much comes to me, so much when I'm not working, quote, unquote, where I'm vacuuming and I'm doing the dishes or I'm just having a conversation or going for a walk, and suddenly this fabulous idea comes, and I wasn't working, but because of that, I've now – so it never stops, really. The engine keeps turning.
I keep a notepad in almost every room of the house because every now and then, oh my gosh, and I'll sit and I have to write something down, and I do.
Yeah.
And I remember when I worked on screenplays, for some reason when I'd get stuck, I found that getting in the car and just going for a drive and not thinking about anything, and all of a sudden an idea would pop into my head to solve a problem. So I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
It does work.
I write, one of the things I write about is the creative process. It's incredibly interesting to me. And I do think that there is, that writing is such a, to me, and I think to most of the writers I know, such a, the, that the vibrational set point for you is listening. That what you're really, it's closer to listening than I would call thinking, and and it's receptive, you know. And I think that what we do, and I wonder if you, if it, this resonates with you, that sometimes we reach those points where we can't know where to go forward, and my brain tries to kick in to solve the problem, which I'm never supposed to do. But when I stop thinking and stop trying and relax, the answer that was waiting there but I wouldn't let in comes, like when I'm driving, like when I'm taking a shower or whenever. So I stop trying that I allow it in.
I agree with
you. Does that make sense?
Very much so. And, you know, maybe it takes time to learn to trust that.
Yeah.
You know, it can be like, oh, my gosh, I'm stuck. And, well, no, you're not stuck. You're going to find that answer eventually.
But you got it. But you've got to get out of the way.
The important thing for me, and maybe this comes from the days in working in the theater, but I find that I have to find the voice of my characters.
Yeah.
And once I have that voice, you know, firmly in my head, you know, I actually talk about it as trying to follow my characters on the path. I just do that, and I find that I cannot impose anything on my characters that is not honest to them.
I know, and this is why I love talking to writers, Stephen, aside from the fact that I am one. I always say that if people are looking, viewing this, they can see my picture, and beneath my crunchy, conventional exterior is a chewy, woo-woo center, because I feel like when you write, there's no way you can get around the spiritual aspect of it, which is that you are following, quote-unquote, these characters, even though theoretically these characters are you, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I
they're
agree.
Coming through you. And so, but you are following. That's absolutely what you're doing, even though you're all alone. You are following something that
absolutely.
Isn't you.
Yeah.
You got to trust in that.
Isn't it interesting, too, when you talk about the process of writing? I'm with you. I love reading about what the process of other writers is. I don't know why I find that so fascinating, but I absolutely do. I like knowing what they're thinking, how they tick, you know, how they produce their best work. I really am interested in that, always.
Well, I'll tell you, I think, see, now there's another thing you and I share, which is we both raised boys who got that label that more and more kids are getting this day, is spectrum. I don't know what yours exactly was, but I don't care. I get so sick of these diagnoses. But, you know, they're on the spectrum order, spectrum whatever. And I'm sure it was a profound experience for you in terms of, as any kid is, but I think there's something particularly acute about having these kids who don't fit the normal, what we think of as the normal mold. And
yeah.
And you wrote a beautiful piece about it that you sent to me, which I and that was published, was it not, the Notes on My Son?
Yes, I think it was published in, I think it's like the Asperger's Autism Journal, something like that.
Okay. So maybe you could fill, because part of the Practical Navigator deals with a father who's got a son who's going through some of these things too. And so first, just maybe fill us in a bit on your own experience with your son, who's quite the swimmer, apparently.
My son is. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, he's 19 years old now.
The audience knows what we're talking about.
Let me say, I so totally agree with you. I hate labels. I don't think labels apply. And if they do, I just don't like them. I mean, I find my son the most unique, interesting individual, you know, with all these strengths that he has. And I just adore him. And I think the thing that I touch on in The Practical Navigator is I think the most frightening time was when we first got that diagnosis. He was maybe 5 years old. And frankly, when somebody said autism, Asperger's, whatever they wanted to apply it to back then, it was like, what's that, huh?
Yeah.
And I remember starting to read about it, and it just seemed worse and worse and worse. And it was like, oh, my God, what do we do? How do we approach this? What do we do about this? What's going to happen to him? And it's been a journey. It's been a journey of learning all the way, and I don't have to tell you it has been enormously rewarding, and at the same time, it's been sometimes very, very nerve-wracking.
Yes, but I want to stress to our listeners, when he said rewarding, that is not Pollyanna. When you have kids like this, I mean, raising children is always challenging and rewarding, but sometimes I think it may be easy for listeners or people who aren't raising kids with these kinds of, who are dealing with life in this way, to think that when we the parents of these kids say it's rewarding, we're just trying to put a happy face on it. It's absolutely not, because these kids, as I wrote this piece for the New York Times, or this essay about raising my son, how it affected my whole life, not just my relationship with him, you are forced to look at life differently.
That was a magnificent piece. I just love it, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And the upshot of it was, the title of it was, No One Is Broken. And that was what I was forced to see in the world. And I wouldn't give up that point of view for anything, you know, to see him graduate from Harvard. I wouldn't give up that point of view. It's so useful to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because there's something you see differently that you might not have seen without that kid.
I agree. And I just see my son sees things and reacts to things in such a totally unique way that I have learned so much from him. It's like, oh my gosh, huh?
Yeah.
I mean, I sometimes think there is just this magnificent, beautiful innocence about him. There is this ability to speak his mind in the most unfiltered way. It's remarkable. Yeah.
It is, and my son does the same thing, and it both terrifies me, that unfilteredness, and I marvel, because of course I'm used to filtering myself considerably.
Of course.
You know, that's how I grew up. Now as an adult, I learn how to integrate it so I don't feel filtered, but I'm aware of like what you're supposed to say and not supposed to say, all the things. But these kids often don't operate by those rules, and while it frightens me because I think what's going to happen to them, I also see the honesty that everybody is thinking but not saying, and these kids will just say it, the elephant that we are all ignoring so often. You know.
And we're at that point right now with my son where we have discussions about that. He wants to know, was this the right thing?
Right.
Was not the right thing? And if it wasn't, why wasn't it? And, these are discussions we have.
And, you know, one of the reasons I brought it up, I'm writing or just finished writing a book called Fearless Writing, which is about a sort of what I call unconditional love for whatever the story you're telling is. And I'm going to write a book called No One Is Broken about having unconditional love for kids. And there's to me, a direct link between raising kids like this and writing a story. And you touched on it earlier when you talked about following your characters, because when you start a book, you know, you so have to trust that even though you don't know how it's going to end, probably, although do you outline much?
I can tell you a story about that, but if you'd like, I never outlined. And then sometime early into my screenwriting, quote unquote, career, a producer said, well, okay, I look forward to seeing the outline. And I said, well, I don't outline. And he said, oh yeah, you do. And so I sat down and I did an outline, and it was torture. It took me 3 weeks, brought the outline in. We went over it. Great. I went back and I wrote the screenplay in about 4 weeks. And I thought, why have I never done this before?
Oh, really?
And so I always try to write notes about, you know, where something is going now, always.
Right. But I'm sure that when you start writing, changes occur.
Of course.
Yeah. This is the connection between the creative process and raising kids like our sons, which is to raise them, I have to trust in something that is operative in all of us that knows that I can't see but is guiding the process. Just like there's the creative engine that is giving those answers that I'm waiting for, you know, when we get blocked and we wait and then the answer comes. That same thing is operative in the kids, but I have to trust that there's something going on that I can't meddle with and it is beyond my perception even, but is operative just as much in me as it is in them, and that they will guide me. I mean, who would you have ever predicted your son would swim the English Channel when he was 6?
Oh, God.
Or 10?
I mean...
Right?
No, never in a million years.
Right.
And
that wasn't your job to
know
that.
Yeah, it wasn't my job to know that. My son, I don't know. He, for example, from an early age, maybe it's because it's something I did, but he would love to try and go and play tennis and golf with me. And I loved having him do that. And all of a sudden, now at the age of 19, he's pretty good. I mean, not just pretty good,
he's
quite good. And I'm thinking, where did that come from? Well, it came from... you know, us doing that all the time. And I would have never expected it. So that's there.
Yeah. But I mean, so much of writing process is a trust. You've got to trust the impulse. You know, you got to trust that you have this idea that's interesting to you and other people will find it interesting because you don't know. You don't know.
You don't know. No.
Right?
I think, too, one of the things I'm always having to to work against is what I call not getting ahead of myself. I mean, I literally sat down about 3 or 4 months ago after, you know, really not sure, being sure what I wanted to do for and started something new. And I suddenly realized I was dealing with all this anxiety about it, and I suddenly thought, oh, my God, I'm already thinking about finishing this. I'm not even thinking about the work that's going to go into it. And, I mean, I wasn't being present with it. I was thinking so far down the road. And I suppose the same thing is true of parenthood. You know, if you start thinking too far in the future, you know, you're going to get in your own way.
You know, in fact, I'll tell you one of the things, in some of the early drafts of the book I want to write about my relationship with Sawyer, that's my son, I realized that early on when people said he had these behaviors that were odd, but I didn't think anything of it until people said, you know, that's going to be a problem. And suddenly I saw these things as a problem. And as soon as you see them as a problem, they're a problem. You need to fix them, you know, and none of which we were able to do by fixing. But I remember early on, to be absolutely honest, what I would see him doing his thing that was he would thump his chest and hum and flap and talk to himself and really block out the world. I would have the thought, what if this doesn't get better? And, like, what if he becomes one of those people I see on the street as an adult with his beard and his shoeless? And the reason that terrified me, Stephen, is because I didn't believe I could be happy as a father if my son was that. And so, really, it was my future that was in jeopardy, not his.
Yeah.
I was really worrying for myself because I didn't believe I would ever be happy if he could not thrive. And so I looked at him thinking, you must get better or I won't be happy.
Yeah.
And guess how that worked. You know, think about you. It's one thing to have, you've got to go to Harvard or you've got to be a doctor or you've got, but I just the same thing. If you can't thrive, I don't know how I'll be happy. And that was the first thing I had to get over. He was a threat to me.
I agree with that. Yeah.
You know?
I agree with that very much. Sometimes, you know, my son likes to talk about what he might do someday. And
right.
Interesting. I mean, some of the things I think, well, that ain't going to happen. I never say that,
right.
But I, you know, we get it down to a point now, and he always repeats it to me. He says, if I'm happy doing what I'm doing, you'll be happy. And I said, well, yeah, if it is meaningful to you, that is all that matters to me. And,
right.
You know, I agree with you. That's what's important to me. If he's, you know, cleaning swimming pools and he's happy doing it, I'm thrilled and happy for him.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny you say that. When I was at the throes of I went through a long period where I wasn't having any kind of success with my work. It was very depressing to me, and I'd always been so ambitious, you know, and it seemed like it should have just happened, but nothing was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I was very upset. In fact, it was actually my relationship with Sawyer that really turned it around. It was my dealing with him that allowed me to see my writing and myself differently. But when I was in the throes of it, I was taking this walk, and I was so bitter, and I was thinking about quitting. You know, I should just quit. I should just give it all up. And I thought about all the people who love me, you know, and I was feeling so bitter. I thought, you know what? They wouldn't even care because they just want me to be happy. I actually stopped my walk and I said, well, that's interesting. It's true. The people who love me don't care whether I succeed at writing or not. They don't care if I'm happy being a waiter or happy. And I thought, okay, then I got to work from that because we don't care, really. You know,
I've had any number of times in my life where I thought, oh, man, why didn't I go into my brother went into, quote-unquote, finance. Why didn't I do that?
Right.
Or why didn't I go into advertising? Would somebody offer me a job doing something, please?
But you couldn't give it up. You don't have to think and say, and face the blank page and say, I don't know. What today is different than yesterday, always, always.
I agree.
Right?
You know, the thought of going in a place where all I have to do is react as opposed to act to create, I mean,
right.
Oh, my gosh, sometimes that sounds great.
Yeah, doesn't
sometimes.
It?
Yeah.
Yeah. it's challenging. But, you know, it's worth it. And I love that, you know, because you've written all these things. I listed off. These are only some of your credits that I listed off. And yet, here you are, a new project. And you start all over again, and you're interested all over again, and you have to face those fears all over again.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We don't want it to end.
Well, you're absolutely right. What is that? I forget one of the great Philip Roth books where he talks about his mentor, and the mentor says something to the effect that, you know, what is his day? Well, I write three sentences. I rewrite those three sentences. I break for lunch. I come back. I look at the three sentences again. I rewrite the three sentences, and maybe I try to write another three. And I'm thinking, my God. But sometimes that is the process, isn't it?
That is, sometimes. Sometimes, yeah. As long as you can be content with it.
Yeah.
Content with it. As long as you cannot judge it. And you know, it's funny, Steve, and I coach people and teach people, and one of the things I find I'm coaching them about all the time is not thinking about the future. Just that.
Mm-hmm.
That is the greatest threat to, especially to beginning writers who can't understand how what they're doing will lead to anything. You at least have,
mm-hmm,
seen things through, and you understand the link between the blank page and a movie or a book or a stage play, although I'm sure sometimes it's hard to see. But that future, that unwritten future, is often the biggest challenge to a lot of beginning writers, that they can't understand. It's not like a job where you go in and now you're getting paid. Somehow you have to predict the future, but you can't. You can't.
Well, you know, something in a funny sort of way, I feel so somewhat grateful that I started as a playwright because, you know, I hit New York City when I was, 23, 24 years old. I immediately fell into the company of other young artists, actors, directors. It was enormously supportive. And so it felt like I was part of a group of people creating something. And I didn't feel as if I was just stuck by myself. I felt like everything I had to share, I was going to get a reaction to. I was going to get an opinion on.
Right.
I was going to get talked about. And that, I think that really was enormously helpful in the beginning. You know, I think it gave me that kind of encouragement. It gave me that kind of community that I thought was really, really a very, very big deal when I was a beginning writer.
Yeah, and you got used to the idea of your work having a life outside of your head, kind of.
Yes.
Because I'm sure you got some actors together and did readings and that kind of thing.
All the time, yes.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you got
It's profound,
also
isn't it?
Seeing, it is. And the other thing about that is you really got an opportunity to sort of see this works, but this doesn't. Okay, why doesn't it? And addressing that. And, you know, it was a real learning experience, yeah.
Yeah, I remember I did theater too, but I wrote and was in it too. And I remember being on stage doing this live performance and thinking, this is going on too long. I'm going to go rewrite this when I get home. You know, but there was nothing like that live audience experience to know this is just too long.
I've done that too, and my favorite story about that is coming off stage. A friend and a fellow actor, he turns to me and says, "Don't you ever talk to me about paraphrasing again?" Because I'd gotten up there and just made total hash of my own lines, and so.
Oh really? Decided, well, I'm free to do what I want.
It's my play, man.
Well, Stephen, this has been a very fast 30 minutes, I have to say.
Oh well, I've really enjoyed it. I love talking about writing, and I love listening to people talk about writing.
Well, I have my motto for this little show is that what it takes to write the book you want to write is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead, and I mean it. Because I think life is a creative act, and the thing about us writers, or all writers, is that we're forced to do it on purpose. You can create accidentally and say, how did I get here? I don't understand my life. Mm-hmm. Or you can say, the page is blank. What do I want on it? And writers have to say, what do I want to create? Like, I have to choose every single word. Why am I going to do that? I just think it's a fascinating process, thinking and creating on purpose. Nothing like it.
I agree. And I wonder, in closing, I wanted to – the one thing I have always found, too, is, especially in the theater, I found it in everything, is that a first draft is the beginning.
Right. Right.
So, anyway.
And it's, and meaning don't put too much on it. Don't expect too much of it.
I just think it's almost creating this template that you can take, and now I can develop this. I can refine this.
Right.
I can expound on this. I can take it and go in any direction I have, and I always have this to go back to.
Yeah, you know, I like that. You know, I like it's a kind way of treating your work. It's allowing for growth, and I won't even call them mistakes, but choices you understand aren't the choices you want to make, but there's maybe no punishment in removing them, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's kind.
Yeah.
We got to be kind with ourselves. Well, Stephen, good luck with the book. Congratulations. It's out today, The Practical Navigator, where all fine books are sold by St. Martin's Press. And are you going to do a little book tour?
I think I'm doing something in Southern California, and I'm originally from back east, so I'm going to go back east and do a little bit there, and we'll see what happens from there.
All right. Well, listen, best of luck with it, and best of luck with your new project, whatever that is. Don't tell us anything about it. You've got to keep it secret. But and good luck with your son. You know how that goes. Just keep being an awesome dad.
Well, I appreciate that. And, Bill, I really I look forward to reading your work on this. I mean, as mentioned, that essay was enormously moving. And
thank you.
I learned a lot from it as well. I've shared it with a lot of people.
Oh, thank you. I'll say just briefly about that. What's been so beautiful about the response to it has been fantastic. And the concept behind that piece meant a lot to me. It was so moving to me when it came to me, when I thought of it and when I understood it. And that when I finally found a means to share it, and to see the response to be so matched my own feelings about it was tremendously satisfying. So it's really been a fabulous experience.
Well, I'm so glad.
Appreciate your feedback. From another father and writer. Well, Stephen,
yes,
it's been great chatting with you. Stay in touch. If I'm still doing this, when the next book comes out, I'll have to have you back on.
I would love that. And please, let's stay in touch. I can't wait to read yours.
Okay. Take it easy, Stephen.
And you. Thank you, Bill.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, it is fascinating talking about writing, isn't it? It is indeed. It is indeed. And I so enjoyed talking to Stephen about it. I will be back again next week with my erstwhile co-host, R.J. Jeffries, to talk about fearless writing. Yes, another masterclass coming up. Until then, do what you love, people. Go do something you love. That first draft, that's all yours. After that, bam!